parish education department have sent it a number of concerns. One that has been a major concern for a long time is family life. For a long time, Dr. Oscar Feucht held the double position of Secretary of Adult Education and Family Life, and in recent years, those departments have been divided. The most recent director of Family Life Education, and if I'm not using the right terms, Ron, let me know, is the Reverend Ronald Brusius. And we thought that this would be a good time, if you haven't met him, to meet him and to know what the concerns are. Certainly, I think as we read the papers, we realize that the family is under attack in many ways, and yet there are strengths which the Christian family has that perhaps sometimes we don't use. So let's see where we go with what's happening to the family.
Thank you, Dr. Schultz. What's happening to the family? If you have your outline, it's divided into three parts. Is the family losing its influence? What can we do to restore the influence of the family? And does God want the family? I will speak to those three parts. But first of all, I have reversed the third and the second as more logical for me to present it. Family. What comes to mind when you think of family? Mother, father, brothers, sisters, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, all gathered on a weekend or on holidays. That's what it was for me. Even though I only had one brother, we were able to get together at my grandparents' home practically every Sunday on weekends. There were five sisters in my mother's family, and we were very close. We had some beautiful, really enjoyable experiences together. Little children, bigger children, older people, all interacting. Maybe you have that kind of picture of a family. Maybe that's what you think of when you hear the word family. Or mother, father, no brothers and sisters. Another extreme. Or mother, brothers and sisters. At one time, many of us could think of family as living in the same area of the country. And now a lot of us see family as an isolated unit, separated from relatives in other parts of the country. That larger grouping that I talked of, first of all, is what we call the extended family. It's really made up of individual family units. And we have to say that from the standpoint of simple physical closeness, that extended family is losing influence. As I was standing out in the hall during the break, I heard some of you talking about your grandchildren, I believe, and how they were separated. They were in other areas of the country. You reeled off a bunch of age groupings, and you don't see them very often. My own grandchildren are 6, almost 3, and about 6 months old. I don't see them very often. And yet they're very close to me. They're very close to my wife. They're very close to the other kids at home. Why? Because my children call regularly. And at least one of my married daughters writes regularly. The other one calls a couple times a week. Now, there is evidence that families which are separated by as much as 300 miles are still very close because of the telephone, and because of visitations. The physical closeness may be gone, but some of those other ties are still there. Now, when I speak of family tonight, I want to talk about that smaller unit, not the extended family, not the aunts and uncles, the grandparents, but rather the smaller unit. And previously, as we thought of family, we considered it to be husband, breadwinner, wife, homemaker, or housewife, depending upon what term you use, and their children. This was seen not only as the dominant arrangement, but the ideal. Women at home, taking care of the kids, men out making a living. Today, that only represents 13% of the adult households in this nation. 13%. That which we have seen as the ideal is a minority form today. Just to put that in perspective for you, 16% of families are single-parent families. 16%. And single-parent families are growing 19 times faster than two-parent families. And this is according to Bureau of Labor Statistics. Now, the most that we can say about family today, as we try to define it, is that it is at least one adult and one younger person living together in physical proximity, or at least, if they're not living together, identifying as a family. Say somebody's off to college. They still call themselves a family. So we have a wide open variety of families, all coming under the same definition. And so is the family losing its influence? What we have considered to be the family in the past is, in fact, losing its influence in that it does not dominate the society as it once did. At one time, the family was the basic unit of society for not only raising children, but for caring for people. That's the way you cared for older people, for all of age groupings. They lived in families. And what's happened today? Many other institutions and agencies have taken over the functions of the family. So when you talk about rearing the children, about educating the children, the state generally has set compulsory educational standards while still recognizing that moral values were to come from the home. And so you've had challenges to this, like among some of the people in Iowa and other sects saying, we want to educate our children in our own way. And so states have said no, or they've given in and said, yes, you can go ahead. But really the tendency is to think that the state can do a much better job in educating children than families can. And what about elderly people? The state, along with other agencies, have taken over the care of the elderly. And our homes today are really not built to accommodate older people living in that same unit with the younger people. And another teacher that we have, a teacher of values, is entering practically every home where there are children hour upon hour each day and giving a message which is not always compatible with what the parents would like to pass on to their children. And yet, so very often, parents, families do not see that, I heard somebody whisper it, television, as at all dangerous to what is happening in the family. It wasn't too many years ago when we talked about influences on young people. We talked about the home, the family, the church, the school, and peers. Now, we talk about television. We used to call it a secondary agency of socialization, a secondary means of teaching values. We don't call it that anymore. We say that, in fact, it has a tremendous amount of influence. And it comes into the home with a message which, as I said, is not always compatible with what the people in that home believe. And they would not let some stranger come into the home and teach things which they do not believe. But the television is there. In addition to this influence, many of the activities available to family members are segregated according to age groupings. And so we hear that young people would rather be with people of their own age group. And it seems to be a rare teenager, for instance, who would rather spend the time with family or with parents than with peers. And we actually often force young people into those peer activities as we organize various things for them throughout the school stages. My pet peeve used to be the junior high dance. When you would have the seventh graders, the little short boy, and the tall girls, and they're supposed to dance because they're supposed to relate to each other in this way. They're supposed to be social. And so here is this boy who gets shorter and shorter as the girls get taller and taller. I remember one time a mother came up to me and said, "My son enjoys your daughter so much." And I said, "Oh, Rhonda?" That was number two daughter, because Rhonda was just a little taller than herself. And she said, "No, Kathy." And the poor little boy sank down more and more because he was so short. He did grow, by the way, but he had some traumatic years in that junior high period as he was learning to relate, as nobody would dance with him because he was too short. The church itself has segregated people into activities according to grade and age level. And it seems to be the most convenient thing to do. And now with the whole preschool movement, we have those divisions which reach down to 2 years of age and 3 years of age. And definitely there are differences in children in those periods. But what is happening is that we are actually fragmenting families. And so we have to be very careful as we engage in these programs to make sure that instead of tearing apart, we put together. Now, what is happening today in our society, and it's not just unique to this decade, it's been with us for a while, is that many parents feel overcome by the enormity of the task that faces them as they attempt to deal with children on a personal level in a society which has become very impersonal, which has been divided. which has been fragmented into not only age stages, but into individuals. A lot of parents feel very frustrated by what they're facing, and a lot of parents feel guilty. We still expect the family to be the most socially responsible agency that we have. The other one is the school. And so we say that the two which should be the most socially responsible actually have the least power. Now, this is not original to me. Robert Abramovitz has said it. And the agency which has the most power is the least socially responsible. And that agency, again, television. But we come back time after time and say, if kids get out of line, it's the parents' fault. My oldest daughter, with her 6-year-old and her 2.5-year-old, said to me recently, "Dad, I don't want to cut you down or anything, but I don't think you're doing a good job with the two younger kids." Why? Because her 6-year-old and her 2.5-year-old mind better than my 17-year-old and my 12-year-old. And she doesn't remember the struggles that we went through when she was that age. But there is that tendency to pick at the parents. Now, there is also a study, the General Mills study of last year, which says about 66% of parents feel relatively satisfied with what they are doing as parents. They believe that they need help in certain topics and certain areas, but they feel relatively comfortable with what they're doing. But as I listen to young mothers talk about their problems and their frustrations, the frustrations are there. They think that they should have a lot more influence than they actually do in this impersonal and divided society. And we've got a lot of different value systems floating around. Now, as we look at the family in today's society, logically, we would have to say there is no reason for it to exist. For a lot of years, four reasons or four functions have been posited for marriage and family. First of all, procreation, or having children, socialization, or child rearing, and thirdly, the social control of urges, especially the sex urge, and then other areas such as passing on the status that comes from being born into a certain family, that kind of thing. First of all, procreation. In 50% of teenage marriages, the female is already pregnant. The socialization task, the child rearing, is shared with school, church, peers, mass media, all sorts of other influences. Urges, especially the sex urge, are seen by many as natural and exercisable in many contexts. And social barriers, too, have seemingly, but not really, broken down. Is the family losing its influence? Definitely, changes have taken place. And so I'd like to go to the second part, and that is, does God want the family? There is no way that the existence of the family can be explained other than that God has given it to us as a gift. And as we look at that beautiful story told in Genesis 1 and 2, we see a loving God who created man, male and female, in his image as the crowning glory of his creation. I love that story. And whenever we do marriage enrichment, I start off with that Genesis 1 and 2. You think of that. You think of nothing. And God creates out of nothing. And the first day he said it's good. And he continues. And the second day he says it's good. He goes on. And the third day he says it's good. And the fourth day it's good. And the fifth day it's good. And then he creates man, male and female. And what does he say? It's very good. Very good. And he tells us the story of the naming of the animals and all of these activities. And he says there is nobody else for man but male and female. Now that didn't last very long. But even in that section, he inserts a passage which explains this is why a man leaves his father and mother and cleaves unto his wife, and the two become one flesh. Now you find another place where you can explain why we have marriage and why we have family. The only way we can do it is as believing people. The 4 points that I mentioned to you only say what the family does. Have children, socialize them, teach them to control the urges which the society does not like exercised out of privacy, and perpetuate the status of the society. Those aren't good explanations. They only say what the family does. And as I said, we see that breaking down. Now again, the only way we can explain marriage and family is that God has given them to us as a gift. And as you read through Scripture, you'll see that time after time, there are examples which are family examples used. The relationship of a father to his children. The relationship of a mother to her children. Of brothers and sisters relating to one another. And as God sent his Son into the world, he did not have him appear miraculously as an individual, but rather he was born of a virgin who was married to a working man. He was raised in a family which loved him and which cared for him, and which he also loved and cared for himself. And his mother was with him at his death. The first recorded public miracle is at a wedding. And one of the last words before his death is, "Son, behold your mother. And mother, behold your son." He cared for his mother, and he provided for her physical needs, even as he went into death, so that she could live. Live eternally. People try to get rid of the family. They try to explain away the family. They say the family cannot survive. And we can talk about a lot of attempts to get rid of the family, to change the family radically. And you know, every time a government interferes with the family process, it is unsuccessful. You think of Russia as it attempted to change the family. It didn't work. The Russians went to a system where you could get a divorce by simply dropping a postcard in the mailbox on your way to work in the morning. It didn't work. And so they went the other way, and they said, you have to appear before a panel of your peers before you can get a divorce. So they went extremely opposite of where they had been. Not too many years ago, as the Russians seriously thought they would have to fight the Chinese, they said to their people, have more children. Not cut down, but have more so we can have more soldiers. It didn't work. Because people didn't perform, didn't procreate on the whim of the government. And you think of the Israeli experiment and the kibbutzim and the commune. And there are many different communes, about 128 or so different ones, and many different forms. But as they came together, they said, we are all going to be equal. We will all keep our own names. And children will belong to the commune, not to the parents. And that worked pretty well, as they were really in the really bad fighting period. But as they became more prosperous, what happened? They started spending more time as husband and wife and more time with their own children. Even those kibbutzim where the children are still reared separately. And so what you see is not a destruction of the family, not a destruction of marriage, but a very, very slight alteration in the style. And as people comment on what is happening today, they're saying now, you do not see the destruction of marriage, the destruction of the family, but what you see are some slight changes. Again, I do not believe that the family will be destroyed. The family will survive because God has given it to us. And what do we do? What can we do to restore the influence of the family? In the midst of some rather bleak happenings, there are some positive signs. Think back to the Industrial Revolution, for instance. The position of the father in the home, when they were working in factories, became largely that of breadwinner, or more recently, coal or senior breadwinner. More and more, the tasks of child rearing and child care became associated with the mother. In the late 60s and the early 70s, as I looked for books on the role of the father, I could not find any. And if you observe children in play, when they're playing mother and father, probably you would see the little girl being very busy and doing a lot of things, and the little boy maybe going out a real door or an imaginary door, off to work, not really knowing what he is supposed to do, but coming back in then on the whim of the mother. Now, as I was a child, that was a little different, because I have a cousin, female, who is 3 months older than I am, and she knew I was ticklish. And so in order to get me into that role, she would have me play with the dolls also. And every time I would refuse, she'd tickle me. And I was very ticklish. Until one day I decided I am not going to be ticklish anymore, because I am tired of playing with those dolls. I don't like her dolls. And so I stopped being ticklish. But I lost my role in playing mother and father. And soon, we passed into another phase.
Never to play mother and father again. Now, what's happened? I said there are positive signs. In the last decade, there has been a change. And not only has the importance of the father role been recognized, but also positive ideas have been set forth which emphasize that both father and mother are important caregivers for children. The only thing we had before were articles which said the dire consequences of what happened if the father was weak or the father was absent or the father was alcoholic, so forth and so on. Now we have positive things which recognize that fathers are parents too. And some people, as they hear the word parenting, laugh at it and say, oh, that's one of those catchwords that you people use. But it's not one of those catchwords. It's a word which is trying to convey the notion that both the mother and the father play a role in child care and child rearing. Not only that, but there is a recognition of the importance of both the husband and the wife being involved in the months before the birth of the first child. I can remember my first experience becoming a father. Boy, I was left out. I was in the Navy at the time, and I couldn't even go in the hospital when our first child was born because it was a naval hospital, and they said, we really don't have room for dependents, but we take them, but we don't have rooms for fathers to be pacing around, and so you better go home or go to work. The only recognition I got of my role that day was we had a 12-mile-an-hour speed limit on the base, and I was driving something like 13 or 14 in a euphoric state, driving to the hospital saying, I'm a father. And I was stopped. I said, but I'm a father. And the military policeman, the Marine, said, go ahead, Dad. That was the recognition that I got. Now, my wife and I were close in that process, but I didn't know what I was supposed to do because nobody had ever told me that a father was supposed to be involved in that 9-month period prior to the birth of the child. But today, there are many, many opportunities for the father to be involved also. And I think of my youngest son-in-law and the closeness that he felt for the baby and for his wife as they went through the classes and prepared both of them for the birth. And he was going to be in the delivery room. It was a cesarean section. He tried to follow them in, and they left him out. But he was prepared to handle that situation then. And when the baby came home from the hospital, he was holding the baby. Even in the hospital, he held the baby because it was part of him too. Now that was denied many, many young fathers. As I said, I was one of them. And a lot of young fathers said, okay, you take care of the child until it's housebroken. And then I'll take it from there. But you know what? If they're not involved in that first year of life, they will not probably be as intimately involved in the later years. And what happens when the child is hurt, for instance? Father is playing with the child is hurt, and the child goes running for mother. And the father says, look at that sissy, or has his feelings hurt. If the father is involved in that first year also, he is more likely to be involved with the child for the whole life of the child, and have a much closer relationship. Now, granted, if the child is hurt, it still may run to mother because it spends more time with mother. But what you'll see is a different kind of relationship, and you can get over a lot of the jealousies which may exist between father and child as they compete for the affection of mother and wife. So this is a positive sign that the father is being recognized, that there is a re-emphasis on the beauty of being parents. While you've got the other, the frustrations, we have the movement developing which says, yeah, it's worthwhile being a parent. Another positive sign is the large number of couples who are willing to learn how to better relate to one another through communication courses and other enrichment activities. And although there are those who still believe that anybody who would be willing to talk about marriage, especially their own marriage, must have a problem, there are thousands and thousands who realize that something may be basically good and yet have room for improvement. And as I think back to when I got married, and the preparation that I had for marriage, I cannot really think of anything other than a really positive relationship with my mother. But nobody told me how to be married. In fact, the Navy told me I better not get married. Because when I got married, I was 18 years old. And my wife was 17. We married the week she got out of high school. And as my children prepare for marriage, they say it's all right to marry at a young age because look at how you two turned out. And I say to them, yes, but of all of the people that married at the same time as we did, we are the only ones married today. The only ones of the people that we know who married at that period of time, 1953. And I think of all of those people who were so anxious to get married as they got out of high school. No preparation. Why? Because people have been marrying for centuries and centuries and generation after generation, and it was looked upon as something which you knew how to do naturally. But today we recognize that it does not come naturally. And so people are seeking help before they marry. And people are saying, hey, we really would like to learn how to talk to each other better after they marry. Also, there are many good programs which aid people in their roles as parents. And that is something which has changed too. And I attribute part of it to the adult education boom. If you look at your continuing education schedules and you see the courses that are offered, I never thought that I would see people taking things such as ballroom dancing or small engine repair or how to tune up your own car. You know, I have to have a course on how to identify the motor. And I get confused because one is a Volkswagen with the engine in the rear and one's a Chevette with the engine in the front. People are taking all sorts of courses. More and more we recognize that we are learners for life. And so, along with this, we see more and more people saying, hey, I would like to know a little bit more about this being a parent. Another positive trend, which I have a caution about, but I see it as positive, is the whole emphasis on values and values clarification. Many parents have either taken for granted that their children believed the way they did, or bemoaned the fact that their parents that their children believed differently. At the same time, many of these parents had never shared their beliefs in words with their children. And values clarification is teaching people the process of recognizing their own beliefs and the beliefs of their children. And that's what it's doing. Now, I believe that we have to emphasize with people that they must share what they believe with their children. I remember a mother saying to me, as she talked about her child, and especially her sexual activities, well, I don't know what Kathy is doing, but I think she believes the way I believe. And I said to her, have you ever shared with her anything in the sexual area, anything that you believe? And she said, no, I haven't. The next session that she came back, she said, about 11 o'clock last night, Kathy wanted to talk about sex. I said, what did you do? She said, I went to bed before she could say anything more. she believed, but she didn't know what she believed because she had never said it. And she didn't know what her daughter believed. We have to get people to recognize that they've got to share their beliefs in words with their children. That their actions have to be consistent with their beliefs, and that their children are going to learn not only from the actions, but from the words. Okay. Again, what can we do to restore the influence of the family? We have to do something which is rather difficult for many of us. We have to recognize the plurality of family systems and the differences in lifestyles among people today. Now, if there is a lifestyle which is anti-Christian, I'm not saying we have to condone it. What I'm saying is we have to recognize what we have in our society and in our churches. We have to recognize that the family will never be destroyed. We have to recognize the influences which have taken away from the family and those which are aids to the family. And so I talked about television, for instance. Are we going to get rid of television? No. Are we going to greatly modify what television offers? I doubt it. Can we simply turn it off? Probably not. I turned a show off in my home a couple of years ago because the values it portrayed were definitely anti-family values. And I told my children that. And they called me mean and arbitrary. And as I talked to other people in my congregation about that particular program, every single person I talked to watched it, and every single person said, but it's such a good show. And I said, but don't you realize that it's teaching values? That's going to continue. What can you do? What can we do as church? What can you do as individuals? View television intelligently. Critique it. Talk about your values. Talk about what you believe. And as individual church people and church leaders, we have to be talking about television. We have to be talking about the other influences. But we have to do more than simply talk about those outside influences. We have to look at what we are doing. What does that mean? We have to ask ourselves whether we are really serious about working with the family, or do we simply expect the family members to work with us as the church? Stated in another way, I believe that we must begin programming towards family units and towards living units rather than toward the church and toward the school. And so as you look at, for instance, parent organizations, very often parent organizations exist to help the school. And yet, there is more influence in what happens in the family than in the school. And so, it's a simple process. It's difficult, but it's simple. As teachers, as parents, we say, what can we, as school, do to help the home? Simple, but difficult. And as church, we also have to say, what can we do as church to help the family right where it is? And what happens when you start thinking that way is that you encounter resistance from parents, too. Because very often, we think that the church and the school should be the ones who are really helping us there rather than at home. Just one example. I changed my confirmation program to a family-centered confirmation where I had the students and their parents in the same classroom always. Now, that took a great deal of trust on the part of the parents, but it worked. And I remember one father coming to me and saying to me about his daughter, my daughter is weak on the means of grace. And I knew what he was doing. He was saying, Pastor, you failed. And I said, what did you do about it? He said, well, we sat down and studied it together. And I said, what do you think the program's all about? I really never would have known that she was weak on the means of grace before. But here, father and daughter interacting around the Word. It was a beautiful thing to behold. And it worked. But it's tough to do. Because it's different, because they constantly point back, but you are the one. And the church has to say, hey, we're equipping you. We're equipping you to live as saints while you're both saint and sinner. So taking into account family units and the diversity of units, we have to look at all of the activities of the church and the home from a family perspective. And the most obvious and visible church function is the worship service itself. Who is it directed to? Is it directed to some anonymous individual at some ideal age level? Or does it take into account the many different people who gather together? I believe that children's sermons are an excellent way of recognizing the diversity which exists. When we minister to children in that way, people can see that we are serious about ministering to family units. And at the same time, we do not offend those who do not live in that type of family. Because very often, adults enjoy children's sermons as much or as more than children. And I don't know how many pastors haven't heard, "Oh, Pastor, I got so much out of your children's sermon." Not that I didn't get anything out of the other one. And I remember I used to see my elders who were on duty in the sacristy peeking out the curtain during the children's sermon to make sure they caught the objects that were being used. Intergenerational education. Bringing together people of different ages is a good way. Bring together all of these people and have them study. Study either in an activity way or whatever way you can. And if you advertise it as intergenerational rather than as a family activity, you can bring together singles, single parents, and all sorts of people. And one of the problems that single parents very often encounter is that there is a breakdown in discipline between parent and child. And so there's that tension. And we struggle with how can we help reestablish that tie. If you can get the parent and the children together in the same situation, working together, you'll get them talking to each other again. Okay. The heart and center of the family is the marriage. I've talked about only 13% and 16% single parents. I could talk about other figures too. But the heart and center of the family is the marriage itself. And while we have to recognize and we have to minister to all of the various people, the singles, single parents, every effort should be made to strengthen that marriage in order to strengthen the family units. And one program that we have is Marriage Enrichment Experience, offered by our Board of Parish Education. And it's a very good way of getting couples to communicate in better patterns. And within a year, we will have introduced that in about 15 of our 38 districts. Strong marriages are able to cope better with the joys and the frustrations of being parents. There are many other good programs, too, which can be offered easily by congregations and organized by interested couples. In the time I have been involved in marriage enrichment, I have seen couples who have been married as long as 49 years involved. 49 years. And for parents, of course, there's effectiveness training for Lutherans, which is one way of teaching skills to help them better communicate with the children. It's a method. It's not a philosophy. It's a method. There are also family enrichment activities and programs which can be conducted with a minimum of training and cost. And for those professional workers who would like to improve their personal counseling and their own skills and work on their own marriages, their own relationships, we offer the marriage education and counseling seminars. Now, these are just a couple of suggestions on what can be done for families to help restore their influence. What can be done by the church? What can be done by your church? In summary, let me say, what can we do to restore the influence of the family? First of all, take the family seriously. Take the family into account when developing programs. Offer programs to help the family live as family. And above all, thank God that He has given us families.